From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
We have a long history here in Greater Manchester of our communities standing together during difficult times.
We'll have the latest on the Manchester Arena attack. Also today, a new report reveals sexual abuse by faculty and staff for more than 40 years at St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire. Plus, remembering JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth.
And Jack and Bobby, two brothers, a dynasty, and one of the most complicated and consequential political relationships in American history.
So the gift that Jack gave Bobby the night of their election victory was an engraved case that said, "You're after me, you're next."
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. British police have identified a 22-year-old British man as the bomber who attacked the Manchester Arena yesterday. They say Salman Abedi detonated a homemade bomb at the end of an Ariana Grande concert, killing at least 22 children, teens, and adults, and injuring many dozens more. Here's British Prime Minister Theresa May speaking earlier this morning.
It is now beyond doubt that the people of Manchester and of this country have fallen victim to a callous terrorist attack. This attack stands out for its appalling, sickening cowardice, deliberately targeting innocent, defenseless children and young people.
Greater Manchester Police Chief Constable Ian Hopkins said Abedi is of Libyan descent and that, quote, the priority remains to establish whether he was acting alone or as part of a network. Well, joining us now is Muhammad Rahim, North American Executive Director of the UK-based Quilliam International, a counter-extremist organization. Mr. Rahim, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, first of all, what's your reaction to Manchester Police saying that it may be a British-born person of Libyan descent who attacked the arena yesterday?
You know, this is a concern. I worked for U.S. counterterrorism for over a decade, and I would have been one of those analysts sifting through the data and trying to understand what's taking place. What we have is a community, particularly in the U.K., that is diverse. It's very different than the American context, particularly with Muslim communities. And so the challenge, particularly with law enforcement, intelligence services, state security services at large, is the ability to address a growing threat that's evolving, that's adaptive, that's morphed from the days of Al-Qaeda to now ISIS, and to what Quilliam we describe as self-starters. Oftentimes you hear the term lone wolf. We're a bit more surgical in our language in calling it self-starters, meaning there are individuals who are self-starting and radicalizing based off of a number of factors. And so this is alarming. This is concerning. It's something that we are addressing at the local level as well as the strategic high-level issues as well.
Mm. Well, the so-called Islamic State has claimed some responsibility for the attack. They posted in Arabic and English on their channels about this. I mean, how significant is it that we have this claim?
You know, there's not a surprise in terms of the Islamic State seeking to get notoriety and attention. They've been doing this for quite some time. So whether it is the Islamic State formally or it's informally them or someone who's just inspired by their rhetoric, what it shows is that the organization is diverse, it's adaptive, it's seeking to be as creative as possible. It's something that we have to monitor, itself. And so for me as a counterterrorism observer, as a researcher, as someone who monitors this and has been doing this well over 15 years, it's something that we have to be aggressive and proactive on. Any time that we see that sort of law enforcement is going in and going after doors, if you will, it's too late. It's the early stages prevention, working closely with Muslim communities. This cannot be seen as the new normal. Yeah. Communities themselves must take hold and be more attentive, more resilient, and more deliberate in their efforts to combat violent extremism.
So let me ask you about that, because, I mean, I just want to emphasize there's still so very much that we do not know. I mean, this is obviously an extremely active investigation. And by the way, as an aside, I'm seeing here in The Guardian that British police confirmed the suspect Abadi's identity only after officials in the United States passed that information to reporters against the wishes of British police and security services. So take us into that a little bit. I mean, what's the difference between the United States and the UK in terms of revealing identities of people they believe, you know, may have perpetrated these terrible attacks?
You know, the U.S. and the U.K., we're a separate country, we have different laws. I mean, the time-honored issue that you've probably been hearing about quite some times of intelligence sharing, it is vital that in terms of law enforcement, intelligence apparatus are sharing information in real time. You know, sometimes it's a puzzle piece trying to put things together. So it's not a picture-perfect image. Countries themselves oftentimes aren't communicating with their fellow state security apparatus as well. And so this information being shared allegedly by American security folks, the jury's still out, you know. But what I will say is that this is something that has to be done. And as information is coming in, sort of in fragmented pieces, trying to synthesize this in a way where it's coherent is a challenge. I mean, to be quite frankly, it's not easy. And it's a difficult for some of the brave men and women who are counterterrorism officials, both in the U.S. and the U.K. Mm-hmm. as well.
Now, Mohammed Rahim, I'm just looking at this reporting that's just coming in, you know, just now or the past several minutes here. The Guardian is saying that even before Abadi was named, members of Manchester's Libyan community wondered whether the attacker may have been one of their own. And this is a quote from The Guardian, perhaps one of the young men who had fought in Libya during the 2011 revolution, some of whom came home traumatized and angry. Respond to that.
You know, this is communities themselves have some internal digging and going on too as well. It's not easy. Communities, whether it's Libyan, whether it's Syrians, it's Iraqi, doesn't matter the particular ethnicity, they are struggling with trying to deal with the reality of there's a problem. It's no different than within sort of inner cities of dealing with crimes that sometimes it's hard to face and look inward. But to the fact of the matter is anytime you see innocent young children, boys and girls, who could be your niece, could be your nephew, could be your child, this is when communities have to make the distinction between what should be done that is right and that which is should be considered wrong. There is no justification for these actions. It's a crime against humanity. It's a crime against their religion as a whole. And it's a crime against those who seek to promote pluralism and seek to have a better life as they've migrated from very difficult conditions, whether it was in Libya or in other conflict zone areas throughout the world.
So let me ask you more then about a community like the Libyan community in Manchester. I mean, right now, even though we're less than 24 hours after this awful attack, we're still looking back now with not necessarily 2020 vision, but wondering, you know, what might have been. Again, this reporting coming in just now, members of the community recalling Salman Ramadan Abadi, again, the suspect that was named by police as, you know, some people remembering him as a quiet boy, very respectful. Others remembering him at a Manchester walk a mosque, looking at others, quote unquote, with hate. I mean, it's impossible to tell exactly what happened until a full investigation is completed. But if you are in this community right now, I mean, is it a time to take a closer look at anybody who may, you know, look at you, quote unquote, with hate and wonder what might be?
Yeah, I mean, this is what we will gather a lot of information sort of postmortem on what actually took place, perhaps reasons, rationale. We've seen an increase of just recruits with ISIS who've been high on drugs that you may have been hearing reports. So there are many indications that individuals may have mental health issues. They could be on drugs, as I mentioned. There are a number of variables that we just don't know early on in this phase. But what I've been saying for quite some time, and particularly Quilliam, what we've been arguing to as well, and someone who has monitored these issues for quite some time, is that communities themselves are the first lines of defense. Just like first responders are out there dedicating their lives, communities must be part of the solution. Communities also aren't just one single community. The Muslim community is not a monolith. There are many communities. And so there could be an online community this individual could have been involved with. There could have been a physical community this person could have been involved with in the mosque. It could be a community in which he was dealing with sort of challenges with his identity, could be challenges of sexuality, could be challenges of multiplicity of factors that we have to really unpack and think about a bit more. So we will gather more information. Time will tell. But we have to learn from these incidents and that the devastation of a human life, human lives have been destroyed. Families have been disrupted. This isn't just a UK story. This is a human story. And so what I call on is not just our UK friends, not just our American friends, but the entire Muslim community has to do a better job to address this internal threat. It's an existential concern. It's an existential problem. And it's something that the community cannot turn a deaf ear to as well.
What do you say to those people who hear that and respond, well, we cannot vilify and criminalize and treat every Muslim in our, you know, in the community as suspect?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a third generation African American Muslim. I'm part of the indigenous community, born and raised in America, and I worked for the U.S. government protecting the society for over a decade, putting my life in the front lines and working with Muslims, Christians, Jews, Black, White, atheist, agnostic. I'm part of the American Muslim community. And I've traveled throughout the Muslim world too as well. And so what I say is we can't stigmatize an entire 1.5 billion Muslims. But we must also address the reality of a cancer that's within the community. Mm-hmm. And we must address it through a careful, reflective, contemplative engagement that is open and honest.
Okay, so just two more questions here, because I appreciate your candor and also your experience, because there are counterterrorism questions both at the community level and at the global level. Just one more thing I'm seeing from The Guardian's reporting in the past hour here. There are some neighbors around the home where, again, the suspect, Salman Ramadan Abedi, lived, who say that, you know, apparently in recent weeks he had taken to chanting Islamic verses loudly in the street. Now, again, are we living in a world where if someone is doing that, that's cause enough for concern to report them potentially to law enforcement and say, maybe you got to check this guy out? Or is doing so, again, infringing, you know, on the rights of people to live lives being free of being considered a suspect by virtue of just being Muslim?
It's a tough balance, absolutely. I mean, right now you have communities who are, we have to be sensitive to the political climate that we're living in. Anyone who says otherwise, it's not telling the truth. We are in a very difficult time that we're living. I mean, we've seen history certainly repeats itself and has repeated itself. Communities must be practical. They must realize that people are nervous. People are scared. Despite Islam being part of the fabric of UK society from its inception, the reality of Muslims have been part of the American fabric since its inception. It's historical. We know that this is taking place, but the climate that we live in, we must balance between pragmatism and also the reality and complexities of this global epidemic. Without a balance in that fashion, then we will see more people who are alarmed, who will grow in sort of anti-Muslim hatred, some real, some are perceived. And if we don't do it in a way where it's addressing it in a fashion where we're open and honest, then we will have a society that will be more fearful, more intimidated of over 1.5 billion Muslims who've large majority of the American Muslim community, the UK Muslim community, and the globe have been the result. They have seen the result of the atrocities of the Islamic State. More Muslims have been killed by these attacks than others.
Yeah. Well, that's Mohammed Rahim. He's executive director for North America for Quilliam International, a counter-extremist organization based in the UK. Mohammed Rahim, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For more than a decade, Massachusetts has had the lowest number of residents without health insurance in the nation. The state's commitment to health coverage began under Governor Mitt Romney and continued on with the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. But a report out today from the Washington think tank, the Urban Institute, says the House health care plan, the new House health care plan, I should say, would roll back all the gains made since the state passed its historic health coverage law back in 2006. WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports.
Today, we have the first hard numbers about what the House Republican health care plan, championed by Speaker Ryan and President Trump, would look like in Massachusetts. Healthcare for All Policy Director Brian Rossman says the report projects a nearly fourfold increase in the number of residents without health insurance.
Our uninsurance rate would jump up to over 10%, meaning we would actually go back to worse coverage than we had pre-Romney Care, pre-2006.
That's the worst of two options outlined in the report from the Urban Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank that bills itself as independent. Under that worst-case scenario, 445,000 residents would lose or decline health coverage after 5 years. The report outlines a less dramatic option where free coverage for low-income residents continues, but the state stops offering subsidized plans. Rossman says about 90,000 moderate-income residents would become uninsured.
It looks to me like it's a lose-lose scenario. Our best case, a lot of people lose coverage, and our worst case, even more people lose coverage. Either way, people in Massachusetts would have worse health care and more expensive taxes due to the loss of federal funding.
Rossman mentions taxes because the state would have to come up with an additional $1.1 billion a year by 2022 for the best-case scenario, where 90,000 people still lose coverage. Audrey Shelto, president of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts Foundation, commissioned this analysis for a coalition of more than 70 groups formed to assess the state's options if Obamacare is repealed.
It's going to take a tremendous revival of the commitment that we all had as a community back in the early 2000s to come together to retain the maximum level of coverage we can in the face of this type of legislation.
The House bill is now before the U.S. Senate, where some leaders say they will draft their own Obamacare replacement plan. The state's largest employer group is among those who expect a more moderate Senate bill. Chris Geerin is executive vice president at Associated Industries of Massachusetts.
While there is serious concern about the numbers that are in this study, I think that's moderated a bit by the belief that this is not the bill that's going to end up coming out of the Congress.
Geerin says whatever the outcome, the report shows that the state and country have to figure out how to spend less money on health care.
This underscores, again, the crying need for everyone to kind of roll up their sleeves and start working on health care costs.
Governor Charlie Baker has asked the feds to let Massachusetts change some Medicaid rules that would trim expenses. And he and other governors are urging the Senate not to offload major Medicaid costs to states. Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters says the Baker administration is committed to access to health care.
We have always maintained that coverage is very important as a health care sort of bottom line in our state. We have the highest rate of coverage in the country. We need to preserve that, but we also need to ensure that Medicaid is sustainable in the long run.
Uncertainty about what's ahead from Capitol Hill is making a lot of people in Massachusetts anxious. Laura Kiesel, a freelance writer and editor in Arlington, is counting on Medicaid in the coming months for diagnostic tests. She has some early signs of multiple sclerosis. She isn't sure what she would do without Medicaid, known in this state as MassHealth.
If I have these extra costs of health care, I don't know how I would afford being able to live in the Boston area. I don't know how I'd be able to afford to live at all. So having MassHealth cover so many of these services is a huge help to me financially, as well as, for the most part, up until there was this threat of the HCA passing, it was something I didn't have to have anxiety about or stress.
Those are questions many people in Massachusetts are asking.
WBUR's Martha Biebinger. A new investigation into allegations of sexual abuse at St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire, finds this. Quote, put simply but starkly, several former faculty and staff sexually abused children in their care in a variety of ways, from clear boundary violations to repeated sexual relationships to rape, end quote. The report found that 13 former faculty and staff members at St. Paul's engaged in sexual misconduct for over four decades. The report also found that school administrators ignored and in some cases concealed the abuse. Joining me now with more is former Massachusetts Attorney General Scott Harshbarger. He's now senior counsel at the law firm Kasner and Edwards, and he led the investigation into St. Paul's school. Scott Harshbarger, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be back.
I'm glad to have you back, although sadly under these circumstances,
right.
Because the report that you, the investigation, the report that you've written, it sounds like what was going on for 40 years at St. Paul's school was rather horrific.
Well, I think as we, both you and your summary made clear, Meghna, and in our report makes clear that based on this almost year-long investigation into various phases of allegations of sexual misconduct by faculty abusing or taking advantage of students over a period of time at St. Paul's was really a significant pattern of violation of any kind of standard of protection of students from sexual abuse and sexual misconduct by the adults in their care. And this pattern was repeated. It was unfortunately kept relatively secret. And the process of the investigation and frankly the leadership at the St. Paul's School today determined to heal was geared to total transparency about what occurred, what we know, then what can be done moving forward.
Right. Well, I do want to get your thoughts about moving forward in just a moment. But first,
sure.
I mean, share with us some more of the details that you uncovered in this investigation. For example, Reverend Howard White Jr.
Right.
He was one of the folks that was accused of abusing students. Actually later on at St. George's School, but that's after he left St. Paul's School.
Right.
Tell us this story.
Well, it was the tenure of Howard White at St. Paul's that triggered the initial investigation that we were asked to do by the rector at St. Paul's School, an independent investigation to look into what, if anything, occurred during his tenure. And based on that, we identified several possible avenues, but one specific, very serious, repeated pattern of sexual abuse of a student by Reverend Howard White in his tenure. Then when that was revealed in our report, the rector reached out to the community more generally and said that we now want to hear from anybody else in any other period who might have had similar circumstances or be aware of them. And that then unraveled. And what we then came across was a very significant effort by alumni at their 25th reunion in the year 2000 to bring to the attention of the then rector and leadership at St. Paul's School that there were a range of allegations of as many as 20 or more faculty over a period of years that may have abused or engaged in sexual misconduct, male and female, with students.
Right.
And that was the trigger for really bringing this forward because, Meghna, one of the biggest issues that came so clear in the report in our investigation was at the time, so few of these students at the time felt that they could, should, or would even be credited if they brought forth the allegations at the time, because many of the faculty were quite prominent,
right,
very well known.
Well, so Scott Harshbarger, let me ask you, because exactly to that point, I mean, in the case of Reverend White, after he left St. Paul's, he went to St. George's, and the pattern of abuse continued. I mean, to many people listening to this, they're going to, this sounds awfully familiar with what was uncovered with the Catholic Church crisis.
Well, let's give credit where it's due here, Meghna. That is the Boston Globe effort on the spotlight thing with the church revealed the same, when it raised these issues with many of the independent schools, raised the same issue, the pattern of secrecy, the fact that these patterns were known by many people at the time, were either tolerated or avoided it, people knowing about it. So the pattern's very familiar. It's a very consistent pattern, and one that actually in this Commonwealth we have seen and continue to see in the area of child abuse, domestic violence, and other kinds of similar circumstances.
But and if I can just jump in, Scott, and forgive me for interrupting but so the thing about what we learned about what happened with the Catholic Church, the clergy sex abuse crisis there was it was not just the fact of the abuse, which was awful enough as it was, but the fact that the church itself was complicit in covering it up.
Right.
And I'm wondering what you discovered regarding the St. Paul's School investigation. I mean, you looked at a 40-year period from 1948 to 1988. I mean, how much did the administration of the school know, and what did they do in response during that time?
You know, what appears to be the major factor here was either that was one of the biggest problems was very little actual reporting to leadership that occurred. Some things were known, and to the extent that they were known, they might have been dealt with. But what we saw here was that when this information was brought to the attention of the leadership, they looked at it from several factors, but one of them was, you know, in cases where people were deceased already, they felt that the harm had been done, that there was no danger going forward, and therefore it was treated, was tried to be resolved at that level. What it ignored, it seems now clear, was the pain and trauma to the victims, who were just now being able to bring forth their experiences, talk about them, let people know about them. And that limited scope of that investigation really did not became a major problem because it remained a problem for the alumni for many, many years. We then saw it because they came forward and sort of said, look, we thought we'd reported this then. Nobody did anything about it then. We never heard about it. And so now this is the opportunity to deal with it more openly in a transparent and open way. And it's not so clear to me, Meghna, that it was a totally conscious, we are not going to look at this, we refuse to believe it. It was that to some extent there were other factors involved, whether it was the reputation of the institution, whether the fact that, you know, there was the survivor, the people involved had not, were no longer alive and therefore couldn't be examined, but the trauma, the impact that was so clear, and we corroborated in at least 13 cases, and 10 other cases that we of different faculty that we had some information about, was that this information was corroborated. It was severe.
Yeah.
It was known at
well,
the time.
Well, Scott, I've got just under a minute here to go, and there's one last important question I want to ask, because you mentioned the Globe's reporting on this. And the Spotlight team, you know, has reported that at least 67 private schools in New England have faced accusations about staffers sexually abusing or harassing more than 200 students. Again, we just got a couple seconds here, Scott, but how does your report on St. Paul's, your findings there, sort of fit into that bigger picture?
I think it just is a continuation of the same pattern. What I think is important about this particular report and the response of the school is that they are determined that it was crucial moving forward that they clear the record, that they bring this out into the open. It's painful. It has many impacts, but the willingness to be transparent and now to invite even more, making it clear that if alumni have other stories to tell, reports to make, they want to continue to hear them.
Yep.
They want to continue to try to heal and reconcile and establish a level of trust that simply has not been there.
It's important.
And that's a great tribute. That's what I hope we're all learning is
right.
Leaders now matter. The courage.
Scott, I'm so sorry. I've got to cut you off there, but I'm out of time. Scott Harshbarger. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All this week, WBUR is marking the 100th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's birth with a series of stories about his connection to Massachusetts. And as part of the commemoration, we're taking you back to some of the key moments from the Kennedy presidency. Today, the Cuban Missile Crisis. In October 1962, the world seemed to be on the brink of nuclear war. WBUR's Kelly Horan takes us inside the White House at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
On October 16th, President Kennedy tells his brother Robert, the Attorney General, that there is great trouble. That trouble is the discovery of Soviet missile sites in Cuba. A CIA agent briefs the president.
There's a medium-range ballistic missile launch site and two new military encampments in west-central Cuba.
How far advanced is this?
Sir, we've never seen this kind of an installation before.
Even in the Soviet Union?
No, sir.
Kennedy's Joint Chiefs of Staff urges a nuclear strike on the Soviet installations. Air Force General Curtis LeMay tells the president, "We don't have any choice except direct military action." Privately, Kennedy says that the worst advice always comes from those who feared that to be sensible made them seem soft and unheroic. What Kennedy fears is igniting a nuclear war. He tells an aide, "I keep thinking about the children whose lives would be wiped out."
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
On October 22nd, Americans turn on their radios and televisions to hear a somber president deliver a terrifying message.
On the island of Cuba, within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Kennedy describes a clear and present danger and an explicit threat to peace, nuclear warheads that could strike anywhere along the eastern seaboard, including Washington, D.C. In this address, Kennedy walks a rhetorical tightrope between the language of diplomacy and the language of war.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
The youngest president in American history, Kennedy defies generals with decades more experience. Instead of a declaration of war, he announces a seven-point plan that includes a naval blockade. He also makes a direct appeal to the Soviet premier.
I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. He has an opportunity now to move the world back from the abyss of destruction.
In the days that follow, Khrushchev backs down. He agrees to remove the warheads as long as the U.S. does not invade Cuba. Kennedy tells Harry Truman about this development in a telephone call on October 28th.
Hello?
Hello, this is Harry Truman.
Hello, how are you, Mr. President?
Well, I'm all right, and I'm just pleased to death the way these things came out.
Well, we just stay at it, and I just wanted to bring you up to date.
Excerpts from White House recordings and President John F. Kennedy's televised address during the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. Kelly Horan's story originally ran as part of the WBUR series November 1963. Now, there's another remarkable moment in those October 1962 Oval Office tapes. On October 22nd, JFK announced the U.S. naval blockade of Cuba. The next evening, the president and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, discussed the blockade over dinner. And in one of those tapes, JFK says, "I don't think there was a choice." Bobby Kennedy responds to his brother, "Well, there isn't any choice." And he adds, "If the president hadn't acted, quote, I mean, you would have been impeached." And JFK agrees, saying, "I think I would have been impeached."
They were spiritual twins in a way that they would finish one another's sentences.
This is Larry Tai, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon.
The term the Kennedy brothers was used perpetually, but it meant something quite magical. It didn't just mean a co-presidency. It meant two guys with very different strengths who gave the country this opportunity to see not just brothers working together, but collaboration in the best way of trying to solve our problems.
Tai says it's impossible to understand JFK's legacy without understanding the relationship he had with his brother. Again and again, Bobby Kennedy filled the role assigned to all the younger Kennedy brothers: advisor, supporter, and most importantly, protector. Their political relationship was forged in a 1951 trip the brothers took to the Middle East.
Most significantly on that trip, Jack got deathly ill, and Bobby essentially saved his life. He brought him to Okinawa. He got him the medical treatment. His temperature went from 107 back to normal. It was the Addison's disease that Bobby would later help Jack cover up. And if Bobby hadn't been there, who knows whether Jack would have survived.
I mean, is that one of the reasons why in your book you write that their relationship was a reversal of normal sibling roles, with the younger doing extraordinary things for the other, that Bobby was his brother's keeper?
So that was exactly the way that Joe had raised his kids. It was that whoever was the oldest was going to be the first to be president, and the younger ones would look out for and do whatever it took to advance the career of the older one. And Bobby did that more brilliantly than even Joe had ever scripted. He did it when Jack first ran for Congress from Cambridge. He did it much more when he ran his campaign for Senate. And then when Jack ran for president, Bobby was his campaign manager, was his alter ego, was his hatchet man. And as much as any single person alive, it was Bobby Kennedy who made Jack Kennedy president.
Okay. I understand that Bobby Kennedy volunteered in, what, 1946 to work on a campaign, a congressional seat that JFK was running for?
It was. It was that seat from Cambridge, and he had enough faith in Bobby that he gave him the district that mattered the least in East Cambridge, one that he was convinced he was going to lose. And he put Bobby there. He basically told his best buddy, take him out to the movies and don't have him hanging around too much. And he had no sense that this younger brother who Joe Kennedy had described as the runt of the Kennedy litter, Jack had not much faith that he was going to amount to much or be much good in that campaign. And of course, Bobby, like he always did, took that as a challenge. He went out, and while he didn't win his district, he came closer than anybody had dreamed possible, and he proved just how good he was to the point where the next time where it really mattered, when Jack was running for Senate, there was no question who was going to be in charge of that campaign.
I see. So you write about Jack as the statesman and Bobby as the hatchet man.
Absolutely. And that was, in a way, a reversal in roles. Everybody thought that Bobby was the tough guy, the ruthless guy, the mean guy. And the truth was that Jack was just better at having a veneer of being the gentleman. But he was actually the tough guy. And after they did a hatchet job on somebody, it was Bobby who would go the next day and find out, are you really all right? And it was Jack who said, let's just move on.
So let's talk about then the run for the White House in 1960. What specifically did Bobby do on the national level that really distinguished that campaign?
The high-level stuff was he understood just what a fresh guy coming out of the war, a war hero like Jack, could be. And he was running against people who looked like they were 200 years old, like Lyndon Johnson. And Bobby understood just how to position his brother in terms of the guy of new ideas, the guy who was going to create what they called new frontiers ahead for America. Bobby helped Jack craft that in a really brilliant way. But he wasn't content in doing that, and he understood that the high road only goes so far. And so what he also did was, we had talked earlier about how sick Jack was when they were traveling in the Far East. And Bobby understood that his brother had Addison's disease, a very serious condition back then that could be fatal. He had the treatments for the Addison's disease stashed in safe deposit boxes in places around the country where Jack was going to be campaigning. And they all understood that this was something that mattered to Jack, and that if the public understood it, it could doom the campaign. So they lied about it. And that's the kind of low road or deception that Bobby was willing to practice on behalf of his brother. And between the high road and the low road, he pioneered a new way of campaigning to the point where Richard Nixon said that he learned his best tricks from Bobby Kennedy back in 1960.
Amazing. I mean, and as evidence of how remarkably successful the Kennedys were until several years back when we got a fuller understanding of JFK having Addison's disease, the number one public image or the number one image in the public's mind of the Kennedys is of hale and hearty youth, right? Like, right,
exactly.
This family that's in the flower of youth and representing a new age for America.
And that image in the most famous presidential debates ever, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, it was that image that, as much as anything he said, that would give Jack the edge.
You credit Bobby with the decision to put Jack on television.
He decided that the contrast would look great. He decided that it was really essential when you're running against an incumbent vice president that you look like you can handle the stage as an equal with him. And he knew that Jack was smart enough and was affable enough and that Nixon was not an especially appealing-looking guy. He knew that exactly what happened would happen, which is that the country would come away thinking that Jack Kennedy was somebody they wanted over Richard Nixon.
Yeah, I mean, the political acumen on display is truly remarkable because it's one of the defining moments of the dawn of the age of political television.
Absolutely.
We've been talking a great deal about how much Bobby Kennedy supported and influenced Jack Kennedy's rise here. Was it understood throughout that whole time that should Jack win the White House, which of course he did, that Bobby Kennedy would come along with him, as he did as Attorney General?
So the gift that Jack gave Bobby the night of their election victory was an engraved case that said, you're after me, you're next. It was very clear in the way that Jack brought Bobby along that he was not just coming along for the ride as Attorney General, that he came closer to being a co-president than we've ever seen in America's history, and that all of that training, everything that Jack pulled him in on, everything from politics to the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, that this was all training Bobby to be Jack's successor.
So remind us, though, I mean, how much pushback was there? How much criticism was there from outside the Kennedy family for this decision to have the brother as the Attorney General?
So there was a lot of pushback, to the point where a law that's getting a whole lot of attention today in the era of Trump with the Trump family, the so-called nepotism law, is known on Capitol Hill as the Bobby Kennedy Law. And it was passed because of the fear of having families take over a White House like that. And it turned out Bobby Kennedy, when he was appointed by Jack as Attorney General, may have been the least qualified person ever to be named to that position. Mm-hmm. Jack joked that he was giving Bobby the job to give him a little bit of legal experience. He's got to be the only Attorney General ever who had never tried a case in a court of law. And yet, by the time Jack was assassinated, Bobby, I think, deserves to go down as the best Attorney General in the modern era in America.
To this point about the fact that a lot of people are paying close attention to family members in the White House today, can we draw any parallels between the Trump administration and the Kennedy administration in terms of the importance of the role of family here?
Lots of parallels in terms of the confidence, or you could describe it as arrogance, in thinking that because you were elected president, that your brother or your daughter or your son-in-law belong in the White House as well. And Bobby Kennedy was, on the one hand, a case study of the arrogance of a president thinking that his brother deserved to be Attorney General, and yet he met the highest of standards, whether the issue was civil rights, whether it was going after organized crime, whether it was cracking down on an allegedly corrupt Teamsters union and Jimmy Hoffa. Bobby Kennedy did all of that. He defied all the Democrats' political wishes by going after Democrats as well as Republicans. And if the Trumps could live up to that kind of a standard of even-handedness and of an exemplary service, then we can excuse the nepotism. And where they are on that, I'll let you and your listeners judge at this point.
Yeah, that's a big if. And I mean, I think a lot of people might say we should still not excuse that nepotism for a specific reason. And that is that, I mean, family bonds are deep, right? Family loyalty is powerful. And there's constantly the concern that if you're surrounding yourself by family relations, that you may be surrounding yourself by people who can't or won't say no to you, who have blind spots about who you are, which is not what you need in the White House. I mean, did that happen in the Kennedy administration?
So I agree with you, and I agree that the risk is huge. But I want to push back just a little bit because there's another side to that. On the one hand, you want people who aren't your family and don't seem to have this untouchable status because they're the daughter or the son-in-law of the president. On the other hand, Bobby Kennedy proved during the Cuban Missile Crisis and at lots of other times that he was willing to say things and push back against the president in a way that helped the country and in a way that no other cabinet officer would ever have done.
Give me some specific examples.
I'll give you
examples,
a perfect example of it was when the president didn't want to file a tough civil rights bill. He worried about re-election. He worried about the Democratic South and alienating all of his constituents there. And it was only Bobby Kennedy among all of his advisors who said, you got to do this. This is right.
So, Larry, obviously so much went on in the first couple of years, well, I guess the only years of Jack Kennedy's presidency. We can't go over it all because it was cut short on November 22nd, 1963, when the president was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. I want to talk with you about what effect that had on Bobby Kennedy. But before we do that, I want to play a little bit of tape. It's of Robert Kennedy at the Democratic National Convention in 1964, the year following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So here's Bobby Kennedy.
When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out into the stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
That was his first real public coming out after his brother's death. When, in November of 1963, Jack Kennedy was shot, Bobby Kennedy lost three things at once. He lost his brother, his best friend, and his whole sense of personal and political purpose in the world. After a month of helping the family and the country rally after his brother's death, Bobby went off a cliff. He had what Ethel, 50 years later, says was serious clinical depression. Mm. And that speech was his first coming out of that depression and having a sense that he wanted to again play a public role. He decided to run for senator from New York. And he went through something that was as devastating. He actually started, at Jackie Kennedy's suggestion in those days, reading Greek tragedy. Mm-hmm. Now, it was unusual enough for Bobby Kennedy to be reading anything, and the idea that it was Greek tragedy was amazing. And he saw in the story of the Greeks the story of the Kennedys, a family with great hubris whom were struck by tragedy and suddenly lost it all. And he understood that he had to rebuild in a way that Greek tragedies were talking about doing. And he did that in his life. But the death of his brother was his epiphany moment.
Did he see the continuation of his own political career and ambitions as a continuation of his brother's, which were cut short?
Yes. So one step beyond that, he saw his brother as a continuation of his father. He saw himself as a continuation of his brother. It was all about what the whole family had always stood for, and yet Bobby stood for it in a way that I think would have taken him a step beyond what Jack did. Bobby was more passionate than his brother. He was less patient than his brother. When Jack Kennedy was asked in the later years of his presidency, when are you going to give us a strong civil rights bill? When are you going to attack poverty? When are you going to get us out of Vietnam that you had put advisors in? His answer was always the same, when I'm reelected. I think if Bobby had been elected president, his answer would have been 5 minutes from now, that he would have tried to do everything in the earliest days. And if Jack Kennedy's 100 days, his first 100 days, became memorialized, Bobby would have done it in his first 100 hours.
Overall, Larry, it seems to me after this conversation that, you know, if we're going to look at the Kennedys, we can't fully understand one man without the other.
Which explains why 100 years after JFK's birth, we're not just looking back at him, but we're looking back at them and this whole sense of Kennedy family royalty.
Yeah. You know, I mean, out of fairness, there are some people who may be listening to this and thinking that, Larry, you're a little too enthusiastic about the Kennedys because, of course, this is a family that's not stranger to controversy either. Their private lives aside, in their political actions as
sure.
well.
So we talked only briefly about the other side of Bobby, yeah. all the bad things he did. He lied about his brother's Addison disease. He lied about his role in the book 13 Days, the first insider story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Bobby lied about his own role during that crisis. He was, in fact, for the first 6 days, one of the biggest hawks, and he made himself out because he was running for president as a dove. He did lots of things wrong, and nobody will read my book and think that I'm too adoring of them. But in the end, who he was in 1968 and the sense of hope he gave us is not just about nostalgia, it's about today.
Mm. Well, Larry Tai, he's the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry, it is always such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Love being with you. Thank you.
And you can find links to all of WBUR's coverage of 100 years of John F. Kennedy at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.